Welcome back to New Persuasive Words. I'm Scott Jones.
I'm Bill Bohr.
And today we're honored to have on the podcast for the first time the one who actually gave us the inspiration for the name of our podcast.
He actually inspired us to do a podcast.
He actually did do that as well. So if we ever make any significant revenues, we will give you for sure some sort of kickback.
That's great.
Paul, it's great to have you here today. On a recent podcast, we discussed what we thought the essence of Christianity is, and we would love to hear what you think about that today.
Well, I wouldn't want to deviate, actually, from the phrase that I used a few years ago, one-way love, in Grace in Practice. That continues to resonate with me. It's not shifted in its application, and I think it's the heart of it. I'm awfully struck by Pope Francis's new book that's come out about mercy. This particular man understands the vox ipsissimus, what is it? Vox ipsissima Christianismi. He understands the absolute essence of it. And if it's not mercy and absolution and forgiveness, it's really nothing at all. Obviously, there are many elements in Christianity which are in common with other views of life and other wise approaches and so forth and so on. But the full character of unmediated one-way love and mercy is unique to Christianity. And that's the essence of it, as far as I have learned it over the years and experienced it now.
I think Bill and I would wholeheartedly agree with you, not just in content, but in form. You put it so beautifully. Why do you think the church has such a tough time staying on message with its essence, as you just summed it up?
Well, that is the absolute vital question, because we are really we're running on empty here, because we have seemingly, and it's not entirely our fault, have given the impression that we don't believe that. And the real reason is it's what it is the ego is highly defended. It's highly defended. The human, we would say, the sinful self, the bound will, the human being who is entirely compuncted by all sorts of primarily inward defense mechanisms. And these formations always want to do everything they can to stiff on this message, because it involves no control, it involves truth, and reality is painful. And so what happens is that even Christians with the most good motives, and these are not, none of us are not people who want to do the right thing by the gospel, but there are inevitably areas in a person's life that are invincible to this message. They are the hidden areas that everybody has, Christian or not, secular, humanist, atheist, devout, you name it. Everybody has at least one. And by the way, it's usually one. It may play out in a variety of situations, but almost everybody has a profound hurt that is so calcified that it makes it, it's the sore thumb. It's the one great thing. And so what happens is, even Christians of greatly sincere grasp who believe this and understand it to some extent, are reluctant to let it permeate to the painful area. They feel that if this painful area is exposed, they will die. It's that strong. They will die. I've often heard, we know many devout Christians, and someone said of someone else once, and he said, well, she's a totally sold out evangelical Christian, unless it approaches anything that's really important to her. And I mean, that's a straw man, but that could be said of you and me. I mean, I'm all with the program unless it has to do with sex. Or unless it has to do with this primary hurt that I'm living out of or from or deeply invested in. And that is the one core area that the gospel needs to touch. And it's awfully easy to exempt it. So as a result, you have Christians who are simply sitting on unevangelized territory that is extremely deep-seated and profoundly powerful.
If you were going to say the best film that captures the essence of Christianity as you just described it, what would it be?
Well, I thought you were going to say the film that best captures the problem of untouched, calcified, of human lostness and hurt and defense. And that would be, but that's not the question you asked. The answer to that one is easy. That's Citizen Kane. That's an absolute no-brainer. It's never been bettered. It never will be bettered. It never has to be done again. No one has to ever touch the theme again because Orson Welles captured it 100%, albeit with a tremendous amount of beauty and expressionist camera angles. He captured it. In terms of the essence of the gospel, no one has ever bettered, in my little opinion, Akira Kurosawa's 1968 film Red Beard. I know that's frequently stated, but it's simply the case. Understanding the nature of one-way love in its full, radical, utterly terrifying, and totally transforming impact is most enunciated powerfully of all movies that I have ever known or seen by Kurosawa's 3.5-hour so-called epic, Redbeard, which is a litany of about 12 stories of one-way love involving difficult, cankered, and cancered people in which the gospel has its way in the most demolishing walls of Jericho sense. And that movie, I defy anyone, once you can get by the first 20 minutes, who will not come out of that movie just dazzled.
All right, I guess I'll be watching Redbeard today. So you've quoted Huxley, I think, saying that what the world needs is more theological psychologists or psychological theologians. You knew and studied with the great Dr. Frank Lake. Could you just say a couple words about Lake and your connection with him and what your own journey with him was like and what you learned from him?
Well, he influenced it powerfully, Scott. I think I can say that we've known him up close, very close. And we're close to Anne Long, who was one of Frank Lake's last visitors on his deathbed. And this witness that we see in his work was actually written out in the final powerful expressions that he vouched when he was dying. But Frank Lake was a parasitologist of human sin. He wanted to understand, and he came out of a classic low church evangelical with a capital E background in Liverpool area. And he had come out of a really solid CMS type background, but he was so struck in the mission field by the nature of what I've just been saying, that you could have wonderful Christian men and women who were walking around with these great Achilles heels of unevangelized pain and sin and trouble in their lives, that he determined to spend the 30 years of his life when he went back to England trying to get to the root of where did it begin? Where is the core problem? And his findings were controversial, and they will always be controversial, but he was seized with the confidence that there had to be an origin to this degree of human defensiveness and pain. And in his essay, which you can get over the internet, I think one of his final word on the subject is called the presence of Christ or the healing of Christ in primal pain. And that book, I think it's called The Presence of Christ and the Healing of Primal Pain. It's an essay that is beyond powerful. And he because he had no illusions, he rooted the nature of human difficulty and sorrow and pain and suffering and sin in very, very fundamental childhood experiences. And this gave him a kind of entree into the reality of pain. The second thing that Lake did is he developed means. In other words, it's easy for you to say this, right? I mean, it's easy for us to talk about this, but how does it actually work in a person who's suffering enormous chronic relational alienation and divorce, or utter and complete paralysis, or the power of infatuation to make a person burn bridges that are 40 years old, or whatever it may be? He was determined to find some kind of technique that might at least be useful in helping people. And he did develop some techniques that were extremely powerful, albeit harrowing. in their the kind of techniques that all people in the mental health field are attempting to find to get to the root of what's really going on. And he did this. And there are hundreds of people out there, many of them now dead, but many of them still alive, to quote the Book of Acts, you know, they're still alive, who were dealing with fundamental core pain that was completely tripping them up in their lives in all sorts of ways, whom he quietly behind the scenes would get to work with him to try to get to the root of it using forms of rather radical psychotherapy rooted in the experience of pain of Christ on the cross. He said that the experience of pressure with the crown of thorns and the nails themselves and the hanging with the lungs being asphyxiated, he felt that if he could get a person into that kind of position, which sounds fun, right? If he could get a person in that kind of position, there was the empathy of Christ's pain, which would carry them through with support to a place of newness. And I was one of these people whom he helped in that way.
On a related, slightly more explicitly theological question. Your PhD was kind of a hybrid systematic theology, New Testament studies, I think with Caseman. And you in it deal with questions about, you know, how does Jesus relate to Paul? How different is Jesus and or Paul from Second Temple Judaism? Now, these are actually some of the big battlegrounds in theology and New Testament studies today. So could you just like weigh in on that and how you see the theological and biblical studies landscape today?
Well, the there's a lot I could say about that, and that's the subject of a whole cast, I think, or two or three or four at some point if you want to pursue that. What I would say now, I would say two things. First, the New Testament studies, especially in this country, but to some extent elsewhere, less so in Germany, is primarily controlled by former evangelicals or present evangelicals who have characteristically misunderstand the gospel as law. And so they naturally are inclined to favor a view of the gospel, which is essentially the law, which is Old Covenant or the Judaistic understanding of the gospel, which Paul was parrying. So you'll find that evangelicals who have misconstrued from the beginning that the gospel as law are very drawn to a view which seems to baptize the gospel as simply a variant of the law, known as covenantal gnomism, to use the phrase that E.P. Sanders sort of coined partly from W.D. Davies. And by the way, I know these people. I mean, I know them personally. I've spent time with them personally. They're not strangers to me. I know them. I've had dinner with them, and some of them I've spent days and days and days with. So there's a natural tendency of evangelical scholars who are mostly from evangelical backgrounds to carry their own misunderstanding of the gospel into the work of the Old Testament, New Testament. So they're thrilled when someone like Sanders comes along and he is able to somehow decide for them that Christianity is really Judaism or a variant of Judaism, because their Christianity is a variant of Judaism. So it simply mirrors their misunderstanding. So that is a vast factor in the so-called new perspective on Paul. It has more to do with origins of these scholars of evangelical understandings of the gospel, which are not evangelical. They don't know it, but that's governing in 85% of them. Now, the greater and more important idea is that Paul taught what Jesus did. This is a phrase that I got from Ernst Käsemann. He used to read the works of the New Perspective on Paul before he died, and he would laugh with a moderate amount of rage. He said, how can these people mistake the gospel for the law? I mean, how is it possible to? And what he said, it is so clear that Paul's doctrine of the justification of the ungodly is simply the intellectualization of what Jesus actually did in his 3-year ministry. And to turn it into something other than what it is, Käsemann would literally sit and he said, it's unbelievable. And he also added, if you take the view that Christianity is really a variant of Judaism, which is basically the establishment view in most places, oh, they'll say, oh, it's changing, or, oh, people are now beginning to reevaluate anti-right. No, they're not. A few of them are, but they're actually not, because they don't know themselves. You see, if they knew themselves, they would understand why they were thinking these things. But what Kaiserman would say is the trouble with a view that mistakes Christianity for a variant of Judaism is that there is keine Anrede, which he said, there's no address in it. The law never really speaks to the real person. Anrede is a word of address. And he would frequently say this to me, that there's no existential address resonant in a view of Christianity, which is a variant of gnomism, because all that does is scare that you-know-what out of people, and it makes them, as always, become defended, because the law always creates a defended person who will hide from you the reality. The gospel creates openness and access, and the law creates closeness and calcification and defense. So my point is, A, that the new perspective on Paul has more to do with the religious backgrounds of its exponents than with anything else, although that's highly disputed by the people themselves, but I would say it. And secondly, there is no real existential pastoral address in this view. And no wonder that our churches are utterly defenseless against modern critiques, because with the exception of Pope Francis and a couple of people like you all, they don't understand it. They really do believe that Christianity is a variant of gnomism, and it's not.
Paul, you have been someone who survived a career in the church. You're an accomplished churchman. You served churches. You worked in academia, and you lived in the midst of a cantankerous denomination. Yet, in spite of all that, you still seem to say your prayers and have a living, dynamic faith with Christ and the church. We too come out of a mainline denomination, have our scars for it, and have seen great decline. So I guess the two questions I would have for you: one, what makes you hopeful as you reflect on both the past and the present and coming church, and what makes you just discouraged and want to just shake the dust out of your sandals?
Well, I don't want to say the last thing, because that although I know what you're getting at about the dust and the sandals, what I would say is two things about that. First is I would always invite people to read Emil Brunner's 1953 book, Das Missverständnis der Kirche, The Misunderstanding of the Church, which is available in a wonderful. It's a short, brilliant book, and although he was writing in a different context than we are, in some extent, it's never been disputed. I mean, it's an unarguable thesis that Christ did not found anything remotely like a visible or institutional church, and he simply demolishes all views that Christ founded some kind of an institution on the basis of the texts, and it's a brilliant, short, accessible, and everybody I know who's ever read it has finished it and said, why didn't someone give this to me before? So I would say the first thing is I have no confidence in the institutional church to right itself. I want to say that right off the bat. No confidence, zero, zebra, null, none of the institutional church. Well, I want to say it's a good thing. I want to talk about Redbeard here. The gospel is the power of God unto salvation. The people who best had this in the whole history of Christianity were probably the Franciscans on the one hand and the Quakers on the other, because they traveled very, very light. I want to say that the closest thing to a church that I know of outside of small groups of people who you may be in and I am in and we know are all over the place of Christian, praying, Bible-rooted, gospel centered, anchored Christian people is AA. I mean, if you spend time, I'm not a member of AA, but I've had a lot to do with it over the years. And an AA group is a powerful place where the gospel is instantiated in the most dramatic way, and often sort of obliquely or not stated as such in words. And Gerald Hurd said this. Gerald Hurd, one of the great, great figures of pioneering prophetic work in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, he spent his entire life, he grew up in the Church of England and the evangelical wing of it, and he tried to find where is the voice of authentic Christianity. And he was the one who, he thought it was the Quakers, until he discovered that even the Quakers had their institutional hang-ups and problems in Philadelphia. But then he advised Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson, the founder of AA, together with the other wonderful man, came to Heard in Los Angeles in the 30s, or I think it was the late 30s, and said, I want to found a church, a Christian church that will help bound alcoholics with these 12 steps. And Heard said, if you try to found a church, your movement will fail. If you work with small groups of no more of roughly 10 to 15 people, your movement has a chance. It was Heard who conveyed to Bill Wilson the power of what an alternative fellowship could be that was ultimately gospel rooted. And so Heard's insight has never been bettered on that front. So, yes, there are small groups of wonderful creative Christian work going around. But sadly, denominations, primarily because they attract transference, denominations attract father to, they attract parent to child transference, are doomed to be the victims of the transference and the counter transference which they arouse. Now, people will say, well, Paul, that's not very sacramental, or surely God's word is incarnate in whatever it's incarnate. And I say, no, show me that it is. If you can show me that it is, I mean, even John Wesley's work. I mean, have you been around the Methodist Church recently? And have you spent time in institutional Methodism today? I mean, John Wesley is just, I mean, he had a lot of hair. You know, he didn't lose his hair. It's all gone now because he knows what's happened. But that's just not Methodism. I'm not singling out. I can single out my own denomination or anyone you want to mention. So what this means, I mean, I go to church every Sunday. Let me underline that. My wife and I, Mary, we attend church, an Episcopal parish, gladly every Sunday. But the reason we do, and we go to the early morning communion service, which is very traditional language, and they have the prayer of humble access and the confession, because the rector is speaking the gospel. The rector is a wonderful man, about my age, maybe a tad younger, and he is preaching the gospel week after week after week. And the result is, partly because of the great prayer book liturgy from the old prayer book, which was rooted in the justification by faith, that we get something from it. We get something from it. But the moment you begin to think that that has any kind of purchase in some ultimate sense, you will sadly be disappointed.
I wonder if you've noticed this trend among some younger kind of post-evangelical types. They grow up in very conservative Christian backgrounds and settings, and with a kind of, their faith rests on an inerrant Bible that they can prove is inerrant. And then there seems to be this trend where they reject the inerrant Bible, but then replace it with a kind of an inerrant ecclesiology, or kind of perfectionist or narrative or story or character understanding of the church. And you kind of touch on the dangers of in the presence of Christ absence in your systematics. The dangers when we feel the presence of Christ absence of clinging to bibliology or other kind of doctrines, instead of clinging to Christ. Is that sort of, do you see this trend? Is that kind of what you're getting at there?
Yes. I didn't grow up in it. I didn't meet an evangelical Christian until I was 20, during a demonstration after the Kent State. I'd never met an evangelical Christian in my entire life, at least consciously. And during a demonstration in the Kent State in 1970, a tremendous ferment on college campus, I met someone who identified as an evangelical Christian. And of course, at the time, I was repelled, utterly repelled. What I'm trying to say is I've never met someone like this. What happens with these young people? And I'm very sympathetic. I've known hundreds and hundreds, possibly many hundreds of them, is they're right to be anxious about the what they regard as the easy answers or the it's usually moralism. It usually has to do with sex, to be honest with you. That's usually the root of the questions that they have, which are very legitimate in their own experience. What happens, however, is that they're not presented with the gospel. They're presented with this ecclesiology thing, which is a chimera. All those people will end up becoming Roman Catholics. They say they won't, but they will, because if you actually are looking for that kind of father figure need to be satisfied, the logic is ineffable. It's impermeable. If you are a logical person, which they are, there is no way you will avoid becoming a Roman Catholic eventually, no matter what you may say. Orthodoxy, none of us speaks Greek. I mean, maybe Syrian, you know, now, but none of us speaks Greek. And so they're not going to end up in the Antiochian Orthodox Church. They're going to become Roman Catholics. I understand that. But the reason is, on their normal, human, very understandable, for which we need to be deeply sympathetic, movement out of the law, they're not confronted with the gospel. They're presented with ecclesiology, as you say. And I mean, if I meet one other person who says, I think the answer to the whole problem is ecclesiology, I mean, I want to throw up, and B, I want to say, I know where this is going to end. When they run into the gospel, say through Mockingbird, or through your work, which is tied with that, or occasionally you run into it through a person who's a drunk or something like that, or maybe a literary figure. When you run into the gospel, you say, oh, that's what I was looking for. That's what all this piffle, all this liturgical stuff was all a feint to what I really was looking for. What was I looking for? I wanted someone to love me as I am, without mediation or conditions, which in the fact of the matter gives me an entirely new perspective and actually, come to find out, turns me into a nicer, better, kinder, more hopeful human being.
Some of our listeners are seminarians or aspiring young theologians, and I'm wondering what would be your recommended / required reading for folks like that? I mean, what books, concepts, ideas, I mean, would you commend to them without reservation and enthusiastically?
Well, that's first I would say to a guy or woman, male and female, starting the ministry, I'd say first you have to detach from any ideas about the ordained ministry as something objective. You have to subjectify. If you understand the gospel, you may well be led to move forward towards ordination. You may well be drawn to become a classic parish minister. You may well be drawn to invest yourself in something very institutional because God has inspired the specific calling in you to do your work through that work. So I wouldn't sort of try to pull the rug out from under a prospective call, even if it's to formal ministry in my denomination or yours or whatever it is, because it may mean that God is actually leading you towards that, despite the corruption of the institution qua itself. There may be something, you are being drawn to that, and you can do it in a wonderful way. I mean, I look at what Andrew Pearson is doing. He's only 36 years old as of yesterday, and he's the dean of the Cathedral Church of the Advent. And when I see in Birmingham, and what I see what a man that young is doing in an extremely challenging modus vivendi, I just say to myself, you know, God can raise up bread where, you know, Abraham can make bread where we would see stones. And so I wouldn't discourage anyone. In terms of what I would do in terms of reading, I think I would invite everyone to see Redbeard and to see it again and again and again and again and again and again. I would always look for parables. I'm looking at my special bookshelf over here. I would always look for parables of the gospel as it really is in literature and art to underline and deeply fortify someone who really is looking to preach this message. I would definitely invite them to steep themselves in Victor Hugo and in Without Question and in Charles Dickens. These are some of the writers who most powerfully grasp the gospel. I would really want people to look at some of the great literary figures who understood it, and it's very few. I mean, George Eliot was fantastic, but I wouldn't look. Oh, Tolstoy. I would invite people to read. When I was a professor, I got everyone to read Janet's Repentance by George Eliot, which is dazzling picture of the gospel. Dazzling, and it's short. It's only 90 pages. Janet's Repentance, and then I got them to read Father Sergius by Tolstoy, which is one of the most powerful stories about ministry ever written anywhere. And it just, I mean, the class just about had a collective nervous breakdown in a positive sense. I would very much invite people to read Catherine Furz, F as in Frank, U-R-Z, Epsilon, Furz, by Mark Rutherford. It's never even been published in the United States, but it's available on the internet. Catherine Furz, about a young minister who has it completely wrong, but by the grace of God, gets it completely right. And that is an unmistakable building block for a person contemplating the ordained ministry. Catherine Furz, Father Sergius, Janet's Repentance, Dombey and Son by Charles Dickens, Redbeard, and I would say I would offer something like Kim, the novel by Rudyard Kipling, which I think is probably one of the greatest of all novels related to religion and the human predicament. And also it's short, and Redbeard. Those are some of the things I would do. In terms of theological reading, I agree with Mockingbird and all of you that Gerhard Furde, I think his book on being a theologian of the cross is as good as it gets. I would definitely, let's see, I would, I think Beyer, of course, is very good if you're, but just take one of his shorter books, even his early books. You never lose by studying Luther again and again and again. And I could give you the New Testament commentaries that have meant something to me, but those are a few of my thoughts.
Over the years, you have studied with some amazing people and you've had some conversations with really interesting folks. If you could take us back and if we could listen into one of those conversations, which one would you take us to?
I think I would go back to, you know, exempting romantic conversations and exempting conversations with one's immediate family, which are usually decisive. I think I would, I had a conversation with Frank Lake once, personally, when I was talking over something that was of importance to me, that was extraordinarily understanding. I think what you look for in a decisive conversation, you look for the same thing that Pope Francis brought, in my opinion, to visiting the prisoners in Philadelphia recently, when he, that photograph that appeared on the cover of the New York Times. You look for someone who understands you, who sympathizes with you, and who forgives you. Those are the three words. You look for someone who understands you. That is to say, if I were in your position, I might do the same thing or feel the same way. Be somebody who actively sympathizes you, who really takes your part, who would be an advocate and mediator, as it were, if you were under accusation. And thirdly, someone who forgives you for whatever it is that is weighing you down or about which you feel terribly in pain, suffering, guilt, whatever the different emotions might be. And I had a, it was what, the way Frank looked at me, as much as what he said, he did say something very relevant, but it was the way he looked at me as if to say, I am completely with you. I am utterly your friend, and nothing you could say to me would put me off. So I would say that. And then I had a conversation with someone else once, not all that long ago. That was a long time ago, in Denver, in which he basically tried to, without ever saying it, he saw that I was objectifying a number of issues and concerns that I had outside myself, rather than first looking, as the gospel always does, looking at what is in the heart of a man. And he said something that was, you might say, not remotely hortatory or didactic. It was actually very positive and encouraging. But he said it in such a way that I began to stop objectifying all the things that I was bothered about and began to look at myself for the, you know, you might say, the inherent power of those things over me. And that became a very, very powerful insight. So I want to climax by, or finish by saying on that front, that it has everything to do with the kind of person to whom you're speaking. And then what they say may in fact strike you as independently the word of God. Because let me say this, I do want to say this. I'm a very convinced Christian. I'm an absolutely convinced, I hope it's proper to say, gospel anchored Christian. What you are looking for in a conversation is the word of God. You're looking for someone who will not speak out of their own wisdom, good as that is. You want to hear a message from God. And when you have someone who really sympathizes, understands, and is able to forgive, whatever that may mean in that context, you're able to hear independently a word from the Lord. And those are the conversations which tend to be the kind that really do turn a person in their course.
On a related note, you talk a lot in your podcasts about the significance of romantic love for life and even the spiritual life. So for our single listeners, which there are a number, what are PZ's romantic dating tips? Where, if they're looking for love, what would PZ commend them to do?
Well, I've gotten so much heat, Scott and Bill, about what I've said about internet dating. Although what everybody always says is, we know you're right, but, you know, or our experience, no, what they'll say is, unfortunately, our experience mirrors what you're saying. But then they don't like it, obviously. And then today I've gotten some heat on my new podcast, number 208, which is called 5 o'clock World. Some very wonderful heat from some people who say, well, look, what if I were in my 60s and were looking for love and were widowed or a widower and were divorced, but really wanted, are you saying that I can't find, you know, somebody right now who I've never met before, but who I can have a new beginning of a romantic relationship? Because by the way, everybody wants love. I mean, love among the ruins. I mean, the nursing homes are quagmires of orgiastic acting out. And fascinating that people feel so strongly. Just listen to the late songs of Tupper Saucy. You know, the guy who was behind Neon Philharmonic, who's long dead. But his late romantic songs that he did in his 60s, I mean, they speak for a whole generation. But let me get back to this. My dating tips. Now, this, I guess, inspires enormous resistance. I still happen to believe, and this is based on now 25 years of experience, and you can like it or lump it, whatever, that internet dating almost always fails, even internet marriages, because when there's baggage in a relationship, the baggage is indelible, and to be married to someone who you've never met before, and you're their baggage and your baggage, involves a degree of acceptance and a degree of kind of not troubling certain still waters that run deep, that is very hard for a person. In other words, to allow a person's baggage to remain such without wanting to fuss or fix is almost an impossible challenge. So this is why a lot of internet dating, let alone internet marriages, end in a failure. They just do. They're going against reality. What I say, if someone it's always best to meet someone introduced by a friend. I mean, if you have any friends that aren't virtual, if you have any friends, if you're looking for love, you will do best if you are, quote, set up by somebody who actually knows you, who's a part of your life. And there are people in that situation. There are dozens and dozens of people who are out there waiting to meet you, whoever you may be. And yet it needs to be done through something that has a pull within your life. It's like you have to have one of those punters in Cambridge, you know, England. You have to have the pull in the life as you've lived it. So I say, let's say, imagine that I were looking for love at my age, and I'm not. I have love, and I'm very glad that I have the love I have that I also had 44 years ago. You know, it's not a bad thing. But if I were not in that situation, I would go to some old and trusted friend, and I would say, look, any thoughts? And believe me, there are plenty out there. So that's where I would start.
My wife and I have set several people up, and it was very gratifying.
I agree, Scott. If I were in this situation, I would come to you and I would ask, set me up.
Well, actually, you'd be better off going to my wife. She's better at in that department than I am. One other question. What controversy in society, in the church, the world at large, do you think that we are worked up about that is really an issue we should just blow off and not focus so much attention on? And what's an issue or the issue that you think we're ignoring that actually is the sleeper issue of our time that really we ought to attend to because of its gravity and its, you know, its possible danger to our culture?
Well, that's very powerful question. And let's think. I want to say two things about it. I would say that the biggest issue that we are facing currently, I talked about this last week with you, is people's inability to say what they think. There is an embargo on free speech, which is profoundly felt and experienced. It's so felt now that people don't even know they're having it. I mean, it's become so reflexive out of fear that it's literally, it's like living, as I said, in Moscow in 1958. That will end of itself. But I want to say, so if I were to say that all of the issues that we're dealing with, whatever they may happen to be, come under that rubric, I need to be able to say what I think, provided it's in good faith. you know, and sincere. I need to say what I think and then listen to someone else who may disagree, and together we'll talk about it. But the word conversation has become a mantra of the most terrible totalitarian manner. There's no people who use the word conversation don't mean it. They mean a lecture. You know, whoever wants to be told by your teacher, you know, we need to have a conversation about that. What does that mean? It means, you know, you're screwed, you know. So don't tell me about conversation. But what I want to get back to one thing. The issue that we're not dealing with in this, if I may use, but I believe this as a Christian, is mental health. The real core, all the talk about, I don't want to get into any one particular thing, but all the talk about the terrible events that are happening once a week, it seems almost like today in America, and the different ways of looking at it, those are overwhelmingly problems of people who are mentally ill, who desperately need treatment. They need inpatient treatment. They need to be taken out of their lives as they have currently constructed them and put into healing environments, which demands an enormous amount of courage, a tremendous amount of compassion, and a profound sense of reality, which we don't have. And until we are able to deal with the mental health dimension of our situation, we are going to be dealing with the surface, and it will never change. The other thing that's very much in my mind is suicide and assisted suicide. People get upset with me when I say I'm not in favor of assisted suicide, and I understand why people want to commit suicide in an assisted way. I've said to myself, you know, if I could only take a couple of pills and it was painless, I would love to shuffle off this mortal coil myself. I don't throw stones at anyone who thinks that way. But the long-term and eternity-related, the eternal cop-out that suicide in any form essentially represents, because it has such implications after you die. I mean, if you commit suicide, you're leaving hanging so much unfinished business that you go to be one of Marley's friends. Remember in Christmas Carol, out the window, and there were all these men and women of all sorts carrying great anvils attached to their legs by metal chains. Well, that's the price of assisted suicide. Of course, God forgives, but unless you deal with what you have to deal with, and everybody has things, that has great implications for your eternal state. You'll have to deal with them there rather than here, and it's better to deal with them here to the extent that you can under the mercy of God. And I always quote this horrendous, brilliant movie, but it's hilarious. Movie from 1986 called The Sentinel, starring John Carradine as a priest who is living in Brooklyn, and he is the sentinel of the gate to hell. But if you see that movie, which is actually about suicide, there's a depth to that movie, despite its corny, ridiculous nature and power, that we need to hear. To sum it up, we need to look as Christians with enormous compassion but renewed reality at this question of mental health and this question of suicide, which is actually going to only become a bigger thing. That needs to be looked at again with compassion, understanding, but also the understanding that if you commit suicide, you're putting off something that is much easier to deal with now than in the hereafter. I can't believe I just said that. But anyway.
And it's like throwing a psychological hand grenade to survivors.
It is a psychological hand grenade. I mean, think of a friend of mine. What did I read just the other day? I think you've had a case of this, not exactly that situation, but you leave for your children if you have them. Do you know the number of people who commit the percentage of suicides whose children commit suicide? It's, let's just say, if you knew what it was, and I think I know the figure, it's so high that it behooves us to really look at this with great, and believe me, I speak as someone who has felt the way people feel. We need to look at that too.
One of the things that struck me as you were talking about the mental health issue is that we are not willing to spend the money to really address the issue. In my 25 plus years of professional ministry, maybe at the beginning we could get in some people, certain places into long-term care, but we certainly are not able to do that now. We're not willing to spend money on the physical infrastructure of this country, and neither are we willing to spend the money to really adequately deal with the complexities and breadth of mental health issues. I think it was Kurt Vonnegut said that we could have saved the world if we weren't so damn cheap. And I think that that's absolutely the case when it comes to these areas. And it's tragic.
I completely agree, Bill. It's it would involve a, I'll tell you what the issue is, in my opinion, related. It's reality. Reality is very hard to confront. And all you need to do is spend time with homeless people. And many of us do and have in any community you want to name from here to Golgotha. And you will find that, that a degree of commitment is involved in the care that is mammoth. However, as you see in Redbeard, where you have a man dealing with a mentally ill child, there is a mentally ill teenage girl in this 19th century Japanese. It takes such a commitment to deal with someone who has a real mental illness that's repetitive that it's beyond words. However, it is worth it. It is worth it. And this is where the United States, our world we needs to live in, needs to have a radical repositioning to look at the question of mental health. Because look at you and me. I mean, we're all one step away from being problematic ourselves. Nobody listening to this hasn't had a moment in their lives when their stress has been so great that they're one step away from becoming hospitalizable. Bill, I wish I knew you better, and I look forward to that because you strike me as a very loving and delightful person. Well, I just give you a great deal of credit. It is the roughest job. By the P.S., add Diary of a Country Priest, the movie. That scene with the Countess. I mean, that is, see, parish ministry, when it is really right, when it's founded on this principle and on a person who's rooted in it, is the greatest thing in the world. I don't mean to take away from that earlier. It's the greatest thing in the world. And I sense it about you, that you're a natural.
Yeah, the Diary of the Country Priest. I was going to say that earlier when you were listing your books. I used to have my students read that book. It's devastatingly beautiful.
Absolutely.
I think particularly in this day and age, that book's really apropos because most pastors are going to be facing more failure than success. And I think that story is about the grace of beautiful failure.
Yeah, and it's a great film by Bresson, I think.
The film too, both the film and the book are spectacular.
Thanks again so much for taking some time.
Thank you, Paul. It was great.
It was wonderful. We hope we can do it again.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Scott. And what I'm gonna tell you now won't be easy to say before.